Good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is May 19th, 2015. On our agenda today is we're going to have a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2019. We're going to have a work session on House Bill 5020 and then a public hearing on House Bill 2236. And we're going to go in that order. So why don't we open up the public hearing first on House Bill 2019. John, what do we need to know?
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. House Bill 2019A relates to the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. The measure has an emergency clause is effective on passage. There on OLIS is a draft budget report for the measure. There is a -A4 amendment that's also posted out there. What the measure does, the measure expands the Government Ethics Commission membership from 7 to 9 members on July 1st, 2016, specifies methods for selecting the new members, provides procedures for the executive director of the commission to conduct preliminary review phase of ethics complaints and limits the review period to 30 days. It removes a requirement for the Ethics Commission to suspend investigations if criminal investigations commence related to the same issues or conduct. Requires the Commission to make certain information searchable online on or after January 1st, 2017. Thank you.
Perfect. So while we're in public hearing, is there anyone that wants to testify on House Bill 2019? Would you like to testify? Come on up and share your thoughts with us. We're glad you're here. Perfect. Maybe you just share your name for the record.
Yep. My name is Janice Thompson. I'm here just as a resident of Multnomah County. And I've got some written testimony that hopefully is going to be passing around. And my situation is I support this sections 2.5, but not section 1, one of those dilemmas. But I have a suggestion related to a possible amendment for section 1, which is which focuses on the selection of the members of the Ethics Commission. And this suggestion is informed from a history of work, Money and Politics Research Action Project, maybe in Democracy Reform Oregon, and then, you know, finally Common Cause Oregon. But my day job is no longer in that line of work, and so this is strictly my own personal testimony. And I do apologize. This is a policy concern, which, you know, in the best case scenario, I would have. I just don't track state legislation these days, so I apologize for not coming it up with it earlier. But I did feel it was important enough that I thought I would bring it to your attention now. So the forgotten piece, except to Senator Johnson, who's very, very familiar with this. I apologize. All of you are. But Senator Johnson was on the Interim Ethics Commission back in 2006. So I know this is an area that you've thought quite a bit about. Local governments really comprise a significant proportion of the commission's work, and that is, you know, in the hoopla about legislative and administrative scandals, that fact gets lost. So the proposal I have is to have one member appointed by the governor, which would, I think, meet a key goal of the bill, retain the current four members that are suggested by the legislative leadership, and to have the other four members be appointed from a list of, you know, by the governor, from a list of 8 prospects with 2 names each provided by the boards of associations with focused on local governments. And I named 4 there. Obviously, I may have missed 1 or 2, but I think you kind of get the idea. And another way to think about this is that even though the number of public officials in the legislative branch is much smaller than those in either the administrative branch or local government, you know, this, as it currently is, the legislators would have the most control, and so this approach would kind of correct that imbalance. Now, Sections 2 through 5 are the most important parts of the bill, and it's, you know, the tighter timelines do need to be, you know, are only feasible with additional resources. So, you know, it's important to keep the bill moving. Maybe the Section 1 discussion could be moved elsewhere, but I offer this suggestion and submit that if it's not possible, that the original version of the bill was better than the current version in terms of Section 1. So, happy to answer any questions.
Madam Co-Chair, you have a question?
I do, but I'm not sure Ms. Thompson's the best person to ask, and maybe Ms. Zedlick. I'm going to ask it. But I notice, since Ms. Thompson carefully brought us our attention to Section 1, that on page 1, line 18, it says no more than 3 members may be members of the same political party. If you have a commission of 9 people, we have 2 major political parties, well, actually 3 now that the independent party's been certified. I'm not totally and there's going to be a bunch of non-affiliates. I just would like a little bit of clarification about what's going to happen if we don't have any non-affiliated or independent party members who are interested in applying for this, and we have only Democrats and Republicans, at which point you've got 9 people, and it's impossible to have no more than 3 people affiliated with one party. So if there are questions for Ms. Thompson, they probably should go first, and then, Mr. Chair, you can choose whether you want to have Ms. Zedlick.
Gina, did you want to share some thoughts on this? No?
Why did Janice go ahead?
Well, Chair and Senator, I think that is a question for her. I will say, however, many local governments are nonpartisan. They still have party affiliations, but if you want to kind of expand, I think this approach could also provide a dual purpose in that regard, potentially increase the number of folks without political, stated party affiliation. But the more specific question is one better for Ms. Zedlick.
Senator Johnson.
I am very appreciative that Ms. Thompson came and shared this idea. I was quite surprised during the course of time that we were talking about various ethical issues back what now seems light years ago. The preponderance of the complaints come from local government, and I guess I look at this suggestion as a teachable moment. I think that having the benefit of local government folks participating, they meet together, they have government affairs committees, they gather their members and have conversations. And along the general lines of teachable moment, nothing like having somebody in the belly of the beast to be able to speak to the issues that may inform other folks. I know that when Ms. Thompson and I were working on these issues back light years ago, the resistance to formal training on public records, on executive sessions, on those elements that give rise to much of these complaints, I was quite surprised at the palpable resistance. If I were queen, there would be mandatory training for all boards and commissions on exactly those subjects. Special districts would do a good job to reach out to theirs, all the way from cemetery districts up through ports. I'm intrigued by the concepts that Ms. Thompson brought forth, and I'm just appreciative for your effort to broaden the circle of information.
Well, thanks, and I think actually by bringing them more into the fold, if you will, some of those goals could perhaps be better met.
Perfect, thank you. Any other questions or comments?
No.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your time. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on House Bill 2019? I see a few folks snuck in the back. We're good? All right, then I'm going to, Mr. Director, thoughts you wanted to share on this?
Can I hear from Ms. Zedlick about my question?
Oh, okay? Gina, did you want to come share a few thoughts on? No, that's
Thank
fine.
Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Designer Hayward, members of the committee, my name is Gina Zedlick, Senior Policy Advisor for Governor Kate Brown. On ethics and public records. And the first iteration of this, the problem that the governor was trying to solve with this bill was what recently came to light when there were ethical questions around the former governor and noticing how many appointees came from the governor. And so part of this, in terms of reconfiguring the composition of the commission, came from trying to disperse some of that power. So our original idea was to do have the five statewide elected officials appoint, in addition to four members of the legislative body. This went through Senate rules before it came here, and the discussion in that committee, and there was an amendment offered which changed that, and it has been incorporated. That's why it's the A engrossed, and that kept the same expansion of members from 7 to 9, but kept the appointing authority in the legislature. So each caucus leader would essentially appoint two people instead of the one. And then the governor has the ninth appointment. And then that also, I believe that from those amendments, reduced the 4 to 3 of the same party requirement. And that is a more strict requirement, but it keeps the point of it out of the Senate Rules Committee was to make sure, to really keep that commission in a not swayed in one political direction.
But please follow up.
Thank you, if I may. But now I'm really even more confused, Ms. Edlick. My question was, unless I'm not parsing the layers of the section well, section 1(2) is a separate section from the part that it's a separate sub to section 1 than the part that describes who's going to be appointed. And if there's going to be two each from the Democrats in each chamber, if there's going to be four Democrats and four Republicans, by definition, you're going to have four members who are going to be members of the same political party. And section 1(2) says a person who holds any public office except as a member of the commission may not be appointed to the commission. No more than three members may be members of the same political party. So I'm just not, either I'm not doing parsing it well or I'm not understanding the arithmetic.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, I think what would happen is that you might have a Democrat having to appoint a person who's not a Democrat.
So it wouldn't necessarily be legislators who would be being appointed.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, that's correct. No, that it's not a requirement that the legislators do the appointing. The appointments do not have to be filled by legislators. So they would, a legislator would appoint, could appoint a local commissioner, could appoint anybody to serve.
But may I, Mr. Chair?
Of course.
I'm sorry, Senator Johnson, I know you have a question, but I just want to make sure I understand this really well. I understand from what Ms. Thompson said, and I agree. I mean, you look at the mayor of Portland, for example, is a nonpartisan position. But I believe Mayor Hales self-identifies and is registered as a Democrat. I'm just taking him as an example because it's one of my cities. Same with Mayor Doyle. And I don't know what, I'm not looking at ORS 244.050, so I don't know exactly who's prohibited from serving in this. But if that takes out all the people in these local governments who could be there, I mean, I know these are nonpartisan positions, but they aren't actually nonpartisan people. They're usually not non-affiliated voters, right? And it says maybe members of the same political party. So I'm still having trouble figuring out how, unless somebody chose to change their voter registration to become non-affiliated or become the member of a minor party, the chances are pretty good that the people who might be out there and interested in these positions are people who have been involved with our political system. And most of the people who are involved with the political system are affiliated with one party or another. Now, some of them are minor parties, at which point that might help the process. But I'm really struggling with the arithmetic here, and I'm not trying to be difficult, and I should have read this ahead of time, but I didn't even pay attention to this part until Ms. Thompson. I was focusing on the other pieces.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, I think your arithmetic is right. I think practically speaking that, yeah, it could be harder to find people who are willing to serve that a Democrat or a Republican or whatever, whoever knows about in terms of appointing. I mean, that might be more difficult under the...
Worry about passing a bill that's going to actually be impossible or very, very difficult to implement. And I appreciate the governor's intention completely, and I very much support her in her desire to revamp the Ethics Commission, and I appreciate the rationale how this was done, but I'm still struggling a little bit about this structure issue because of this one clause. The rest of it, I think, is copacetic. I mean, I appreciate Ms. Thompson's concerns, and one could put on the record legislative intent to encourage legislative leadership to, among the people that they're suggesting, have local officials, local officials. But I'm struggling with the arithmetic a little bit and figuring out how this is going to really work. Thank you for your patience, Senator.
Senator Johnson.
I want to key off something that you said, and I apologize if I misunderstood you. You had said that you wanted to try to avoid having this swayed, and I wrote down swayed in a partisan direction, and yet we leave the appointing authority to some of the most partisan officers in the process. And I'm just trying to understand what was the rationale behind that. For many of us, this is our first introduction to this bill. We haven't had the benefit of hearing the testimony, but I'm just trying to figure out why we leave it to the most partisan people in the process, the majority leaders.
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson. What I meant to say was that the Governor Brown's intention with the bill was to disperse the gubernatorial. Even the legislative appointments have to be approved by the governor because it's in an executive branch. There's not a direct appointment authority here. So even though there's legislators doing some appointments, they're officially approved by the governor. So what we did, right, but before this bill, there would be four legislative appointments, and then the governor had three direct appointments. And so the bill, in its sort of in our original iteration, took those three direct appointments and replaced them with the five statewides doing the appointments. And then when we were on the Senate side, Senator Farioli offered this amendment that instead of taking those five statewides, which he felt were, at least in the current form, I think are all held by Democrats, moving that back over into the legislative branch, so at least it's politically balanced, and then making, I think, exactly what Senator Hayward is keyed in on is the with the nine members having no more than three of the same party, that's the nonpartisan piece.
I would just follow up by saying we may be stuck where there's no mud. At least I am. I think everybody wants to believe that they are coming into a forum that is neutral, that is charged with ascertaining ethical lapses. There are many of us that would like to give the Ethics Commission longer fangs to be able to really do stuff. And somehow the partisan appointments kind of betray that feeling of neutrality when the partisanship is called out in the bill. And that's worrisome to me. We all want a fair shot at a level playing field. And I fully support the governor's dilution of the gubernatorial power to appoint those people, even though they've gone through Senate confirmation. But it still concerns me who the appointing authorities are and the prism by which Oregonians will see the function of the Ethics Commission. I think we want to lift up what they do after it's been somewhat seen as not having adequate authority or running room to maneuver. And by what we do here in terms of the commission composition, we want to lift it up to a standard of fair play that everybody can agree with.
Yeah, Senator. I mean, Senator Johnson. I think that what we were originally responding to was something that hadn't come to light until there were issues around Governor Kitzhaber, which was the commission seemed all fine until the governor was the one, who was the subject of a complaint, and then lo and behold, he had at that time appointing authority over every member in some capacity. So. That was the problem we set out to solve.
One more comment. Yeah. Your statement, though, begs the question, is it the composition of the commission or is it the rules of conduct that are the really important thing? And I'm asking that as a rhetorical question. I don't know the answer. But if how an investigation would occur of the chief executive officer of the state were laid out in absolute black and white, and there was not subjectivity conferred on the members of the commission to sort of decide as they go, I would submit to you it's pretty unusual to have the chief executive officer of the state subject to ethical concerns. But I'm approaching it slightly differently. It's not who sits at the table. It's what are the rules of engagement prescribed for the table.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith. So my understanding is that with not just with the Ethics Commission, but with many of the boards and commissions, we often have vacancies. We have a lot of vacancies. And so in the past, what's happened with the Ethics Commissions? Has there been chronic vacancies? And if so, I've just been building off what Senator Steiner Hayward was talking about, that if we were ever in a pickle, shall you say politely, again, where there's an opening and some sort of decision has to be made, and there's I'm just concerned there'd be a risk of imbalance or anything like that. I don't know if we've had a problem with there being vacancies on the Ethics Commission or not in the past.
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith, Representative Taylor, and maybe Ron Burson, the Executive Director, is better to speak to that. He's here. But my understanding is that until that there are sometimes that there are delays in appointments, and how I know that the Ethics Commission works is that the person who's currently serving they can serve one term and then you're out, but they sort of extend that term until there's someone there to replace, so that the commission's never
too
small.
Okay, so that's different. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Any other questions or comments, colleagues? Senator Johnson.
I guess one more. During my time here, I have watched the confirmation process, Ethics Commission notwithstanding, but I have watched the confirmation process turn into an ad hominem character assassination exercise. And what worries me is if we make confirmation for boards and commissions so onerous and so despicably nasty, how are we going to get the right quality of Oregonians willing to run this gauntlet to come forward to serve on any board and commission? And I'm sort of just lamenting this publicly. We want the highest caliber of folks serving Oregonians at the Ethics Commission level. And I just don't want us to collectively or individually make this such a nasty place that good Oregonians for a volunteer position that is going to suck up an inordinate amount of time and travel and personal angst, that we make this so unattractive that regardless of how we divvy up the political affiliations, we're not going to get the folks that should righteously be at that table. No response necessary.
All righty. Colleagues, any other thoughts or comments? Is there anyone else that wants to share a thought? Would you like to share a thought? Come on up. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you, Gina.
Thanks, Ms. Edlick. It'll take me a minute.
No problem.
Thank you, Gina.
If you could just tell us your name for the record.
I will. Senator Smith and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cappy Eaton, a governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I really hadn't expected to speak today, but the League really wants this whole process to be transparent. We really feel strongly that local government people who most of the public officials in this state are part of the local government entities. So we are concerned that their representation should be somewhere on that commission, because their complaints come from that area most directly. that's really all I wanted to say was I'm sorry that this is so late in the process, but it was brought to our attention, and I just wanted to comment on that. We don't believe in Ways and Means Committees doing policy, but on the other hand, this is an important issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, looks like you have a comment.
I'll wait, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other comments or questions, colleagues? Thank you very much. All righty. We've given... Yes, Mr. Director, come on up.
I'm really hoping I can help here just a little bit.
Thank you.
So, because I get to live in this world every day.
Right.
Lucky you folks,
you
just get to be here. But... A couple things from, I'm sorry, my name is Ron Burson. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And a couple of things that I've heard in the audience is, first of all, local government is on our commission. I just want to be clear about that. The chair of the commission is out of Marion County, who actually is an attorney for Marion County. Other commissioners are work for the Port of Portland. So it's pretty common that we get members on the commission from local governments around. Now, I'm not here to speak to how the makeup of the commission does, but I just want to make sure that you folks know that it gets drilled down to local government. The second thing on the number of members, it is not unusual the way the current law is only four of one party can be on the commission. So it is not unusual. And as you know, right now, four members actually come from the legislative caucuses. So usually the legislative caucuses kind of fill up their two. And as you know, the governor has three appointments. So it's really not unusual for the governor to appoint somebody that's not inside their own party. So it's common practice that either somebody from the other part, you know, if they're a Democrat, they appoint a Republican. We've had independent, we've had non-affiliated on the commission. And then the last thing I would say is that I would hope that a lot of people would want to serve on this commission. I'm talking to the people that are listening to this right now, because this is the base of government. I mean, you really get to feel all aspects of government, from, like I mentioned earlier, small cemetery districts all the way up to, say, the Port of Portland and as you know, the legislative body here. So those are the things that I would just like the committee to understand. So, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And Director, those members who serve, they are run through a confirmation process in the Senate. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. And I haven't had any come up and been upset over the process. So I think they've been treated fairly on that confirmation side and been confirmed and are happy to serve the commission.
Perfect. Thank you. Any questions for the director? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There seems to be a lot of interest in the bill in its current form. It changed from its original form to some to an amended version based on discussion in the Senate, and we're also comparing it to the current iteration of the composition of membership. So one of the issues is how to feel certain that the experience, the challenges, and the point of view of local government officials would be represented. How are they represented now, and how would this bill change that? When I look at the requirements of the bill and the way things are now, maybe I'm just not reading the right sections here, but I don't see specific direction on who can be recommended or nominated for appointment, who should be considered. I see who gets to participate in doing the nominating, but it seems like the person or office doing the nominating can select a state official, a local government official, a lay person who's not ever been elected to office but has a really good point of view for some reason. Can you help explain that for us?
Sure. Co-chairs, Representative Nathanson, I think you said it exactly correct. Currently, the commission is made up of all of those folks. I mean, we've had state officials. We have folks that are retired out of the private sector. We have all different walks of life as far as professional careers, from attorneys to we have an IT expert on our commission right now. You know, that was their career during their time. So what I have felt, anyway, what I've seen in the time that I've been there, because I've been there just after all that thing they talked about that happened years ago, is that we get quite a variety of folks. And I think that local government is interested in being on the commission. You have to remember that the commission's, and we're going to talk about this on the budget bill, is it's an assessment to local government. And so they, I think since we've done that, there's been an increased interest in being on the commission to see how the commission works and how they can bring that information back to their local jurisdictions, and whether they represent the actual associations or specific local government. But there are people that are not on government at all that just want to come in and be part of this government experience. So I hope I answered your question.
So a brief follow-up.
Yeah, please.
So I think what I'm hearing from you is that there's nothing in this bill that precludes the same variety and diversity from being nominated and appointed than what we currently have.
Co-chairs, Representative Nathan, you're correct. I would hope that whoever's making the appointments, and like I say, that's a policy decision to make, but whoever's making the appointments would look for that variety out there. And like I said, I know as a commission, when we're traveling around, an example, I'm going to go to the School Board Association in July. I will be talking to people about serving on the commission, because I'm always talking about groups about serving on the commission, because it's just I think that everybody that walks away from it is better for it. So,
thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Pershing. The Legislative Fiscal Office report here says that the preliminary review phase will be reduced from 135 days to 30 days, from 4.5 months to a month, and in order to help you do that, they would have another one position, a compliance specialist, 3. Is that all it takes to reduce your time frame from 4.5 months to 30 days?
Co-chair, Senator Whitsitt, no. What the commission's going to get in that 30 days, right now, essentially what we're doing is we're doing a preliminary investigation. It's a pretty comprehensive 135-day look at the case that comes before us. What they're going to get in this bill is that cursory overview that I think was the intended purpose originally for a preliminary review. It just kind of kept growing and getting bigger and bigger as we went along. And so it does take another position to do this, but the actual, that initial preliminary report will be not as involved as it was, just simply because of the time frame. We will include enough information so that the commission can make a decision whether they want to actually investigate that. The other part of the position is that since I'm not doing that 135-day amount of work, the amount of investigation time hasn't changed. So I haven't done all that preliminary work. Now I have to fit that inside of that 180 days that I have for investigation. And at the end of that period, the commission, the 9 members, whoever they are, actually have to make the decision to find a violation at that point. At the end of preliminary review, they just have to make a decision whether to have an investigation or not. So it's important that, you know, that 180 days gets compressed, because I'm not going to do as much, not going to be able to do as much work up front.
So essentially, it's a you're moving the commission's determination of whether there is a founded case here up to the 30-day thing, and either this doesn't sound like we're gonna, it doesn't sound like anything at all, or this is something we should work on. Instead of doing that at 135 days, we're doing it at 30 day.
Senator Whitsitt, that is correct.
Thank you.
Following up on the senator's questions, can you do a 101 training for myself? When is a person notified that an investigation has begun towards him or her?
Co-Chair Smith, I just want to be clear on the terminology here.
Yeah, because I apologize if I'm using the wrong
verbiage.
This preliminary view, a complaint is filed. The commission actually has 2 days to inform somebody of that. And currently the statute requires us to do it by telephone and by mail. You'll notice that this bill lets us notify those folks. It doesn't give us kind of those old antiquated ways to do it.
So how would you anticipate? Would it still be a telephone or an
it could
email?
Be a telephone call, but it all could, also could be an email. It could be, we just have to get notification to them. At the same time, I have to get them all the materials that I've received. And so part of this case management system is being able to digitize those records that come in so that that person that's complained upon has not only the complaint, but all the records in their hand as soon as possible, not waiting for, the regular mail to get there. And so, anyway, we have 2 days to notify them in preliminary review. Investigation, they're aware of that because that is a commission act. There's a commission meeting, there's a commission vote, and they are always encouraged to participate in that.
Perfect. Thank you. All righty. Any questions? Senator Whitson.
Thank you. That brings it
through this guy. Folks.
This person that brings another thought to mind, does 30 days give the potential offender time to gather the require the information necessary to vindicate that person? Or, is that an adequate amount of time for the potential offender to respond?
Co-Chair Senator Whitsitt, I guess my answer to the question is that the 30 days is a limit on my agency working. In other words, I need to get my work done in 30 days. The respondent is not contained within that 30 days. So we're going to have 30 days worth of work, and there's going to be a meeting, and then the commission will decide whether to go into investigation. They can provide information during that entire time. And, of course, they can attend the meeting and supply information to the members of the commission to convince them why they shouldn't go forward with it. But the 30 days doesn't restrict the respondent. It restricts the agency from working on the case until the commission says votes to have an investigation.
And the respondent has time to – respondent has the ability to be present during the committee meeting or during your commission meeting when that's being observed?
Yes. Co-chairs, Senator Witt said yes, they can be present. In fact, they're encouraged to be present at that meeting.
So I guess the last thought I would share is based upon the questions we've had, I'm concerned you're going to have the necessary resources – to deliver within 30 days, and that concerns me. And so I would anticipate in 24 months, we're gonna need to evaluate, do you have the resources you need to fully implement within that time frame? And so hopefully you do, but I'm sure we'll be having that conversation.
I always look forward to coming before the committee to have that evaluation.
All right, colleagues, I think we've given more than adequate time on this. Is there any last questions or comments? All righty, and everyone who's here has had an opportunity to share their thoughts. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2019, and I'm gonna open up a work session on House Bill 2019. John, are we ready to move on this, or would you like to share a thought with us?
Co-chair, members of the subcommittee, there is a -84 amendment. It's a budget amendment for the measure. There's two sections to the amendment. The first section provides $255,076 for the administration, which includes the position and related costs. The second section includes $200,000 for the electronic case management system related to the measure. In total, the costs are $455,076 other funds. The source of the other funds is the agency's normal funding mechanism, which is local entities are assessed based upon a formula of their municipal audit fee, and state agencies are assessed based upon their full-time equivalent. Each is assessed half of the agency's costs. And one last thing, just for the record, the 2017-19 roll-up costs of this measure are $311,487 and one position, one FTE.
Perfect. All right. So, Madam Co-Chair, we're in a work session on House Bill 2019, and
Mr. Chair,
need a motion.
I would move adoption of the -A4 amendment to House Bill 2019.
All righty. Thank you. So, Madam Co-Chair moves adoption of the A4 amendments to House Bill 2019. Is there any discussion on this?
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
I suspect I haven't done my homework well enough. And I'm going to be talking with Ms. Zedlick and maybe Mr. Burson between now and Friday when this is likely to come to full. I'm perfectly prepared to move forward on this today. I hope that I can get my questions answered between now and Friday because I completely support the governor's intention and Mr. Burson's ability to make this all work. I'm still worried about the logistics as have been articulated here. And it may be that we don't need to fix it entirely now. We can fix it in 2016 because it's going to take a little while to get this all up and moving. But I remain concerned, as you do, Mr. Chair, about the adequacy of the resources and about the logistics of appointing these people on the whole party affiliation issue. So I just want to be clear about where I am. Happy to move this forward today, but I want to be crystal clear.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Is there any other comments?
As long as you're given this opportunity for disclaimers, I wish to be associated with the remarks of our co-chair. I think we need to keep going, but I feel very uncomfortable for some of the same reasons that the co-chair does, and I hope to learn from the conversations that she has. I think we all want to make this work right. We all appreciate where the governor's coming from, but rushing as fast as we do towards the end of the session, we sometimes wade into the pond of unintended consequences, and I see us standing on the beach.
I tend to dive in. All righty. Any other comments from the committee?
Yeah.
Colleagues, is there any opposition to the motion before us? Seeing none, so adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2019 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as modified by the -A4 amendment.
All righty. Madam Co-Chair moves House Bill 2019 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as modified by the A4 amendment. Any other comments, colleagues? Any dissension on this? Seeing none, so approved. And it's been moved. I guess I'm going to use the prerogative of the chairmanship, and I'm going to carry this one to full ways and means. And then I imagine House and Senate leadership will want to assign carriers to the House floor and Senate floor. All right. Seeing no other work before us on House Bill 2019, I'm going to close the work session. And we're going to open up a work session, colleagues, on House Bill 5020, Oregon Government Ethics Commission. John.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, House Bill 5020 is the primary budget measure for the Government Ethics Commission. Posted on OLIS are the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendations and work session papers, including KPMs and a -1 amendment to the measure. As just a brief overview, this is another funded agency. The recommendation is for a $2.3 million budget, 8 positions, and 8 FTE. There are the attached work session papers I will go through at the, if it's all right with the chair. Again, a $2.3 million other funds budget, 8 positions and 8 FTE. The first policy package is package 101 on page 3. It's for an electronic filing system. This is for the continuation of an electronic filing system that was first authorized by the 2013 legislature. It would provide $200,000 of other funds expenditure limitation. The electronic filing system has a statutory due date by January 1st, 2016. It is being undertaken by a private vendor and the private vendor is offering project management services, and a separate private vendor is offering project management services to the agency. This is a one-time expenditure that is not to carry forward into the 2015-17 biennium or 17-19 biennium. The project was reported on throughout this last interim, remains on schedule, within scope, and under budget. There is an associated.
Say that again, Mr. Borden. We hear that so rarely.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, the project is on schedule, within scope, and under budget. And if I may just say one other thing, the executive director of the agency has done an extremely impressive job of working on this project, managing the IT portion, working with the Department of Administrative Services, and working with the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Thank you.
There's an associated budget note which will be moved separately associated with this project, but there is instruction that the state's Chief Information Office and the Department of Administrative Services will continue to provide project oversight, procurement support, and quality assurance for the project to the agency. There's an associated package 102, which is the continues to be the electronic filing system. This is for the subscription fee to NIC USA. It's for $127,000 other funds. This is a continuing base budget expense into the future to pay for the development costs and ongoing maintenance and operations of the filing system. Package 801 is an LFO adjustment that makes two technical adjustments to the budget. It increases the agency's beginning balance by $70,645 related to updated projections by the agency, and also makes an technical adjustment of $37,098 to the agency's assessment for the upcoming biennium, bringing it to $1,000,006. And with that, those are the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendations.
Perfect. Senator Whitson.
Mr. Burton, I'm, as usual, confused. Comparing the bill that we just moved and this bill, it appears that part of this money that was in the 219 bill includes the posting of additional information online and subscription fees, but it appears in this bill, but the extra FTE and the money for that compliance specialist does not. How is that going to be realigned?
Co-chair and Senator Whitsitt, the two bills are discrete. House Bill 2019 that you just heard, the preliminary budget report for that is related specifically to that bill, specifically to the case management system and the project management services under that bill, as well as with the new position that is being authorized under that bill. And in discussions with the agency, these two projects, they're ongoing project, and the new case management system are separate and discrete. They will look for economies of scale as they get up under operations with NIC USA, but they're discreetly budgeted and costed. So
if I may follow, then the total budget, assuming that the 2019 bill becomes law, the total budget will increase by $547,000 in one FTE.
The total budget, Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, the total budget, and I don't have the exact increase, but it's about a 10% increase over the current legislatively approved budget. So it's roughly the, and I apologize, it's the $200,000 for the currently authorized electronic filing system, and another $127,000 for the other funds fees.
I probably didn't make myself clear. I understand these are two discrete bills, but at the end of the day, the money for the 2019 bill is going to be added to, assuming it becomes law, is going to be added to their budget.
Yes.
In which case, the total budget for the agency that would be approved by the legislature, not necessarily in this bill, but by the entire legislature, would be about $547,000 larger and an extra FTE, which brings me to the next question, is why are we doing this now and not waiting until this, so we can put it together and do an appropriate budget?
I'm going to pass that to you because that is a good question.
Well, Co-Chair and Senator, the one reason why we do it in this manner is an important reason, and that is if House Bill 2019 fails to become law, then the expenditure limitation and the position authority within that measure is not incorporated into the budget, so that does not impact their primary budget measure.
Mr. Burton, I appreciate that. Also, I appreciate that we have 8 weeks left in the session. Why don't we wait? But, you know, it's a rhetorical question. I know you didn't make the decision.
All righty. Any other questions, colleagues? Mr. Director, we are in a work session. Is there anything you want to add to this bill? You're good? Okay. All righty. Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move that we accept the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5020.
All righty. Colleagues, Madam Co-Chair moves the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5020. Is there any comments on this?
A question.
Yeah, Senator Johnson.
I would just like to know the character of the NIC USA contract. Is it specific deliverables and timelines or... I'm asking this on the record at every chance I get so that we don't have any more of these time and materials contracts.
Can I add?
Yeah, please, okay. Representative.
As opposed to a performance-based contract, for example.
Thank you. Again, my name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And Senator Johnson, to answer your question, the NIC USA contract is, we don't pay anything until it's up and working. So there's no performance base. They have to have a working system, and then the $127 or $127,000 that Mr. Borden talked about is that subscription each year. So we don't pay any development for the system until it works.
That answers my question. Colleagues, in another committee, there is a NIC USA contract that has a kind of interesting clawback in it. This is at ODOT, where records are being sold, and NIC USA is keeping some of the money for cost recovery, and then they're squirreling some of it away in another account. I actually have a meeting later tonight with NIC to try to find out how that works. And I just wanted to make sure that this one on the record is as straight up as it appears. You're buying a certain set of products from them. There's no liability to the agency until the system is up and functional.
Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, that is correct.
Okay. I'm good.
And on time.
Thank you.
And on time.
Yeah, really functional like and on time.
So. Senator Whitsitt.
I have one other question for Mr. Borden. Does the commission have adequate ending balance to cover the cost of this $547,000 increase to the budget if House Bill 2019 is passed, or will it require an additional assessment, and are they authorized to make that assessment?
Co-Chair and Senator, the agency has a sufficient other funds ending balance of 5 months reserve under this measure, and under House Bill 2019 would be, as we discussed earlier, an additional assessment. But the agency generally carries 2 additional months of reserve to accommodate various fluctuations, including compensation plan changes. So,
alrighty. Any other questions for the director, for John?
I have a question for the director.
Can you all type, Mr. Director? We might have questions in the future. All right, so colleagues, we're on moving the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5020. Is there any opposition to this motion? Seeing none, so moved. Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. We better go to John first.
Yeah,
John, can we talk about the KPMs?
LFO recommends approval of the agency's existing KPMs and targets.
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chair, and then look at Mr. Chair, move the LFO recommendation on the key performance measures.
All right. So, colleagues, Madam Co-Chair has moved that we approve the LFO recommendations on key performance measures. Discussion on this?
Yeah. So, okay. Mr. Burson, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, you're talking in House Bill 2019, we talked about changing your timelines a lot, and there was some concern expressed by the members of the committee about challenges in that, and then I look at your KPMs for the most current reserve. For example, of percentage of the statutory time limit used for preliminary reviews, et cetera, et cetera, you're only at 73% with a target of 85%, and yet we're tightening your timelines. And I, like others, want to be sure that you feel comfortable. We understand that you're undergoing a lot of transition, and we want to support you because this is an important transition, and we don't want to set you up to fail. Okay, so I don't want you having to come back here in 2016 or 17 and say, yeah, we're kind of at 63% because you didn't give us enough resources. So can you help us think about that a little bit?
Co-Chair Steiner, first of all, the lower the percentage, the better.
Oh,
so it's like playing golf.
So I made this. Thank you. Maybe I just did this to make my co-chair feel better.
That's okay.
This is a good one. You know, okay.
As math people, we like numbers.
So. I misread this one as the percentage of time that you were under the statutory limit.
Right.
You're right. It's a percentage of the statutory.
But you were correct. The changes in 2019 are going to be challenging for the agency to meet. I mean, that's why there's a fiscal attached to it. And, you know, and I hope not to be back here. But again, you're creating a world that I haven't lived in before. But as far as this key performance measure, I think the percentage of time will still be there. If we use 25 out of the 30 days, you know, it'll be that percentage of time. So I think the measure still works with the new system.
Thank you, and thank you for helping me parse something that I couldn't parse adequately.
I apologize.
So, colleagues, are there any other questions on the motion regarding the key performance measures? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so approved. John.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee.
You're good.
There is one budget note in the agency's budget, and the budget note reads as follows. The Government Ethics Commission is to report to the Interim Joint Committee on Ways and Means in the fall of 2015 to document the agency's readiness to proceed with the implementation of its electronic filing system by the statutory due date of January 1st, 2016.
So, Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move the recommended budget note.
So, colleagues, you've heard the recommended budget note and you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion on this? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so approved.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, the Legislative Fiscal Office again recommends a budget of $2,283,828, other funds and 8 positions and 8 FTE, and that House Bill 5020 be amended accordingly.
Madam Co-Chair.
Chair, I move adoption of the -1 amendment to House Bill 5020.
So, colleagues, Madam Co-Chair has moved the adoption of the -1 amendments to House Bill 5020. Any discussion on this? Any opposition? I'm going to see if the Senator wants to vote. So I'm not hitting the gavel down yet. Hold on one sec.
Betsy, you
want to
vote on this? Oh, yeah.
Okay. The Senator is a yes vote. Is a yes vote. Thank you. Seeing no other opposition. So approved. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair,
Betsy, we're almost there.
Move House Bill 5020 as amended to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any opposition? Seeing none, so approved. Thanks, Senator Johnson.
Thank you for your patience.
Madam Co-Chair, would you carry this one?
I'd be honored, sir.
Sorry. All right. So Madam Co-Chair is going to carry House Bill 5020, the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and I imagine the big co-chairs will figure out where they want to go in the House and the Senate. Or do you want me to assign?
I think maybe best to these.
Will you carry?
Sure.
Will you carry?
Okay. That's a definition. There's the headlights left for Representative Nathanson.
All right. If that's all right, are we good with that? All righty. So we've got our carriers. All right, so I'm going to close. Anything else on this, John? I'm going to close the work session.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 5020. John, really appreciate all the work you did on 2019 and 2020. Appreciate you. Okay. We are now going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2236. Come on up, folks. All right. Representative, we're glad you're here. Do you have some guests with you?
We do. Thank you so much.
Please, come on up. So here's the situation, Representative. We have 20... I'm blind. I can't...
22
minutes. So you have 22 minutes to share everything we need to know on House Bill 2236.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative John Davis. I'm very excited to bring you, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, probably the most important and most significant bill of the legislative session that you will hear, having to do with mass transit assessment for municipally operated transit districts. There is some compelling testimony that comes ahead of me here. I'm also currently sitting in the Revenue Committee, so I will leave for that testimony. But I will say this bill came out unanimously from the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. It would benefit cities, including but perhaps not limited to Albany, Canby, Corvallis, Lebanon, Milton Freewater, Reedsport, Sandy, Silverton, Woodburn, and Wilsonville. And like all bills having to do with anything good or decent, I'm sure it's a jobs bill. And with that, I will pass this off to my distinguished colleagues, and I will run back to revenue. And thank you very much for your time today.
We're glad you're here. We send our best to the revenue folks.
We got them warmed up for you. Yeah.
And we'll try to Milton Freewater.
We'll try to get you some good cash today so you guys can spend it wisely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care, Representative.
I didn't hear track talent.
So welcome.
Thank you.
If you would just introduce yourself for the record.
Certainly. For the record, my name is Stephen Lashbrook. I'm the transit director for the city of Wilsonville. We operate South Metro Area Regional Transit, SMART. On my left is Julie Whaling, who's the transit director for the city of Canby. And we're both here to support House Bill 2236. I would not have told you it was the most important thing you'll deal with, but it could be important to a number of cities around the state. I'll start by pointing out that in this state, we have a whole bunch of different kinds of public transit providers. And the current legislation in ORS 291, 405, and 407 provides funding for those transit agencies that happen to be districts, but it doesn't say anything about cities. And you now know that there are a number of cities around the state that do provide transit services. The other thing you'll find is that of the different transit agencies, they're funded in a variety of different ways. The way ORS 291, 405, and 407 currently work is that where there is a state agency of any kind operating within those transit districts, that there's a payroll in lieu fee paid, goes to the state Department of Administrative Services, and it's returned to those districts for providing those services. Cities are not mentioned in that bill. So House Bill 2236, it's mostly a us too kind of a proposal. Please add us to that language. It's the message. We're not transit districts. We're municipal transit providers. It's kind of ironic, and it works against what Representative Davis just told you, but in fact, the only immediate beneficiary of this might be the city of Sandy, because they have a DMV office located there. So it's a minimal impact, but it's a playing field issue for us in the field who represent cities. The way it's structured, the in-lieu fee would be the lesser of 0.6% of payroll, or the payroll tax rate charged to private employers within that city. So for the cities that don't charge a payroll tax to their private employers, they would, even if this passes, they still would not be able to collect money from those state agencies. Nothing in the bill is intended to change the rules that apply to counties or to transit districts that are already listed in ORS 291, 405, and 407. The last thing I'll say is we really haven't heard any opposition to this. The Board of Directors of the Oregon Transit Association voted unanimously to support this in December, and we would ask for your support as this moves on to the full committee. Thank you.
Perfect. Sandra Johnson.
I have to readily admit that at the pace the legislature is moving right now, I have not studied this bill in depth, and I'm sorry I missed the first part of your testimony. My question is, you're asking for a portion of the DAS assessment of state agencies to run transit districts in selected cities.
I would not use the word transit district. These are the cities that already provide transit services that are not part of a district in the sense that TriMet is a district, Lane Transit is a district.
Let me just tell you right up front, I have real problems with this bill. I've got it. If we start with you, when does the DAS assessment stop? This is not a spigot of money to turn on to fund everything anybody wants to fund it. And regardless of how laudable the project is, but these are, in some cases, are just laundered general fund dollars that are being ground out of agencies to feed DAS. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that I'm aware of some transit districts that are so poorly run, I'm not saying any that you're associated with, that they are not auditable. And so what's the criteria to know whether or not the transit providers are doing a good job? I mean, we've got a situation going in my district right now that the transit agency cannot survive a public election to become a district. Their fees are exorbitant, and they have turned to a 300% increase on a natural resource extraction business, gravel mining, in order to fund those services. I just think that's outrageous. And so I'm trying to understand why it is for the handful of cities that there's a state obligation to pay for this. Where are the citizens who value the service? Why haven't they stepped up and passed a bond?
Well, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, if I can respond to that, I'd point out that we're talking about cities. In our city, we have two state agencies operating currently.
Just remind me what city.
Wilsonville.
Okay.
So Coffee Creek Correctional Facility is one of those. It's within the TriMet service territory. They pay this fee. It's doled back to TriMet for their operations. We're not able to collect any from as in Sandy's case, if there were a DMV office in our city, we would not be able to collect any. Yet, if it were still in TriMet service territory, as Wilsonville was before 26 years ago, TriMet would be able to collect it. That's why my point is it's a levelizing effort. It's trying to give us the same status as the transit districts have for those state agencies operating within their jurisdictions.
Let me further understand this. So if a municipality running a transit agency has a state function, then they would be eligible?
Right.
I guess, Mr. Chair, the thing that bothers me is I think all of us recognize that transit, it, to some degree, needs to be subsidized. But this is becoming sort of opportunistic. Let's just find somebody we can go get other people's money to run. And have any of these cities gone out for a levy for operations?
Well, let me talk about ours in particular. The three cities in Clackamas County that have transit services, and Julie manages one of them, all function on payroll taxes paid by private businesses in our jurisdictions.
Okay.
My department gets no general fund support. We run on those payroll taxes and whatever grant funds we can manage to cobble together from year to year, and our fares. So
this is municipal general fund.
Right.
Okay.
So my point is, for us, the private entities are already paying for our services, and I would argue that it's fair for the state agencies operating there to do the same. We provide them services.
Okay. Senator Whitson, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. I learned a couple of months ago that the Salem-Keizer transit system is primarily funded by local property taxes. I was really warmed to know that. About 85% of the fare that the public employees would generally be paying are actually being supplemented or replaced by our property taxes. So, in this plan, is there any intent to reduce the fare for public employees who use the transit system?
Mr. Co-Chair, not necessarily. I mean, that would actually surprise me. At the start of my comments, I pointed out we've got a whole bunch of different kinds of public transit providers in the state, and they're funded by a whole bunch of different systems. I'm aware that Salem-Keizer is property tax-based. Lane Transit and TriMet are both payroll tax-based.
Liberally subsidized by general fund. Go ahead.
Right. So there are all different kinds of combinations of things happening out there. Corvallis uses a user fee basis in the community and doesn't charge a fare. So it's really hard to say, well, this is standardized across the industry. Salem-Keizer's in a fairly unique spot by being a pretty big. They supply a lot of trips to a lot of riders, yet they're still property tax based. That's fairly unusual.
Thank you. So we're running out of time. So Julie, I want to give you time to share your thoughts, and then committee, if we have any follow-up questions, we can ask them then. So welcome.
Okay, I'm Julie Whaling, Transit Director for the City of Canby. Good afternoon, Chair Smith, Chair Senator Hayward, members. Thank you for this opportunity. The City of Canby provides public transportation through a Canby Area Transit, which is commonly known as CAT. We call ourselves CAT. The service began in 2002 when the city withdrew from TriMet's district. CAT operates as a department of the city and has provided more than 2.2 million rides since its inception. We really appreciate Representative Davis's sponsorship of this legislation on behalf of CAT and the other cities in Oregon that take advantage of the payroll tax. Under the current statute, the Oregon Department of Administrative Services collects payroll taxes from state agencies operating within mass transit district boundaries. But the statute ignores public transit services like CAT that are operated by a city instead of a mass transit district. And House Bill 2236 corrects this oversight and levels the playing field for the city-operated businesses that take advantage of payroll tax. Even though we're not aware of any state agency operating within the Canby boundary at this time, we feel that this legislation provides equity should it happen at some time in the future. And on behalf of the City of Canby and Canby Area Transit, I ask that you support the passage of House Bill 2236. We think that it's the fair thing to do.
Thank you. Any questions, colleagues? Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All righty. So I jumped out way ahead of ourselves. Is there any cleanup you want to do in terms of what this legislation is or what it is not?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, this was just scheduled for a public hearing, so it's up to the co-chairs of Ways and Means how and when we proceed with this.
Perfect. All righty. Thank you, colleagues. Any questions or comments from the committee? Senator.
Thank you. You know, if it would be possible, it would certainly be interesting for me to see how many different sources of funding and how many overlapping sources of funding public transit has, whether they're federal and state and local property taxes, local payroll taxes, user
districts.
Just get some idea of how this is funded, because obviously it isn't funded by fares.
All righty. Any other comments or questions from the committee? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All righty. And we appreciate your representative bringing this issue forward. All righty, colleagues, anything else we want to visit about today? We've had a busy afternoon. Julie, we good? All righty. We're going to adjourn for the day. Adjourn for the day. We're going to